So I thought I'd repeat an idea we did a few years ago, which was talking about Mahavakya. The idea was, when I first thought of it, I said, this is Mahasamadhi. That's a good topic. Mahavakya. Go together, right? A great samadhi with a great statement. So, Mahavakya means great sayings, and a number of great sayings that relate to our teachings. Some come from the Upanishads, others come from the Kailasa Parampara, Chalapa Swami, Yoga Swami, and Gurudeva himself all have some great sayings, so I thought I'd go through some of them and kind of get you into the spirit of great sayings, and then let you do the work. Any of you who want to write down one great saying that of Gurudeva's which influenced you, and then you can tell us about it. In the second half. So the four great sayings or Mahavakya from the Upanishads, you probably know most of them. The first one is a little obscure. Rajanam Brahma, pure consciousness is God. That's the one we don't hear very often. Aham Brahmasmi, that one is very popular. I am God. Tattvamasi, thou art that. And I am Atma Brahma, the soul is God. So certainly these ideas permeate all of the Parampara teachings and Gurudeva's in a very direct way, claiming the identity of the soul with God, or more specifically, as Gurudeva likes to say, that the essence of the soul is identical with Shiva. Or we in our essence are always one with God. There's never a time we're not, we just don't realize it, we don't see it. So, Chalapa Swami, excuse my Tamil, this is written in English, so I don't know what's long and what's short. I'd be much better on this in Tamil script. So, this is written in English, so Oru Polapumilai, there is not one wrong thing. Pavo Mundinda Kariyam, it has been accomplished long ago. Nam Mariom, we do not know. And Mulugan Unmai, all is true. So, this is a very interesting emphasis there, which goes through Yoga Swami and comes through Yoga Swami and Gurudeva as well, and it's found in the Mahavakya, Nam Ariyom, we do not know. In other words, that's backwards from what we usually think. You know, we go to school to learn, we're supposed to know. Great spiritual teachers are supposed to know. They know all about God. They know all about this. They know all about that. And so, what does the great spiritual teacher say? We do not know. He's not supposed to say that, right? He's supposed to say, oh, I know the answers. You know, what question do you want answered? I'll tell you the answer. You know, he's supposed to be all-knowing and give us the answers. But Chalapa Swami says, Nam Ariyom. We don't know. So what does he mean? Well, he means that our intellect, our normal knowing faculty, our reasoning faculty, can't really grasp the deeper truths. Or, as Yogaswami said, you know, he likes to scold, you know, so people who would read a lot of books, he would scold them and tell them, it's not in books, you fool, right? I'm sure in a very fiery way. Not in books, people. So, meaning, you'll never understand the deeper spiritual truths from reading books. Or just by sitting down and thinking, you won't figure it out. So that's the part of us that doesn't know, the intellect. We have to go deeper than the intellect. We have to go into the superconscious. We have to experience it in a profound way. And then, you know, we know, but even then we can't really explain it. The deeper truths can't be explained, so that would be another Mahavakyam that Chalaka Swami could say, well, it can't be explained. So it's like anything profound, you can't really explain it. Even a beautiful kawaii sky, you know, you have a few clouds and then there's a rainbow and another rainbow and sun's coming up over here, the moon's going down over there, and you come out and, you know, you see one of those fantastic kawaii skies. You can't really explain it to someone who hasn't seen it, you know, even something as simple as that. So we need to experience the more profound aspects of spirituality in order to understand them. So, another point, another Mahavakya that's very relevant today at Chalapas is the first one, Oru Pola Umilla. There is not one wrong thing. So people these days like to think, but there's lots of wrong things. The world should not be as it is. This is terrible. All these things are going on, and they're worried about it, and talking about it, and like somehow it's wrong. It could be avoided. But Chalapa's Mahavakya says, well, that's not really the right way of looking at it. If we were looking at it from God's point of view, we'd understand why it's happening, what set it in motion in the past. Maybe it could have been avoided in some way or changed, but whatever happens is set in motion in the past and plays out in the present. So really all you can do is change the future. You know, put energy into doing things to create a better future. But it's pointless to worry about the present and think it could be otherwise than it is, because it's a result of what's been set in motion in the past. So that's one of the meanings. There is not one wrong thing. Everything is a result of karma. Everything was set in motion in the past. Somehow we just can't see it. So, moving on, Yogaswami. Of course, his most famous Mahavakyam is Tannai Ari, Know Thyself. And of course, it's also Gurudeva's most dominant Mahavakyam, Knowing the Self. Yogaswami also says Sarvam Sivam Seyal. Siva is doing it all. Sarvam Sivamayam, all is Siva, all is pervaded by Siva, and Suma Iru, be still. So those are Yogaswami's Mahavakya. The most important, of course, is Know Thyself, Tanmai Ari. So I gathered a few of Gurudeva's Mahavakya, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 that I think are important, and these may catalyze you. You're welcome to choose one of these if you want to explain it. The idea is to talk about it in a way that relates it to your life, how this Mahavakya has influenced my life. So if you find one here that you want to choose, that's fine. Because maybe I took all the best ones. So, first group. Two in most of these groups. The purpose of life is to realize the self. The ultimate reason we are here on earth is to realize the timeless, formless, faithless self-God. So that, of course, is very important. Because it's so easy to get involved in life and forget the real purpose. You know, we get involved in all the day-to-day details of life, all the challenges of life, all the problems of our family and relatives, and problems at work, and problems, health problems, this kind of financial problems, the list of problems, political problems, economic problems. You know, we get involved in problems, and we lose the overview. We know what we're doing today, what time we're going to work, what we're having for dinner, you know, but we've forgotten the purpose of life. So, fortunately, Gurudeva doesn't just say it once or twice, he keeps repeating it throughout his teachings to bring us back to the point that the purpose of life is to realize the self. Well, what does that mean, really, when it comes down to it? You know, how many of us are going to realize the self today? Well, it means the purpose of life is to make spiritual progress. That's another way of saying the same thing. That's you know, step-down version, the less philosophical version, is to live our life so we make spiritual progress. We can live life and not make any spiritual progress at all. You know, it's not automatic. We can live life and go backwards spiritually. We can be worse off at the end of our life than we were at the beginning of our life. You know, because we have free will. We have free will. So Gurudeva is saying, you know, let's live our life wisely so we make spiritual progress. And one of the ways I find helpful in understanding what that means is Gurudeva's explanation of moksha, which is another way of talking about realizing the self, moksha. It says, moksha, liberation from rebirth on earth, comes, and gives two things, when all karmas have been resolved and when realization of the self has been achieved. So not just one thing. It doesn't say moksha comes when realization of the self has been achieved. He says when all karmas have been resolved and realization of the self and achieved. So what does that tell us? How we manage our karma is very important. In fact, it's the key to making spiritual progress. And that's not our official topic this morning, so we have a whole series of classes on managing karma. But the basic idea is, you know, when our karma comes back to us, in other words, when people treat us the way we don't want to be treated, and that's our karma coming back to us, we receive it gracefully, we don't react, we thank them for mistreating us. And that's a whole class in itself, why we thank them for mistreating us. But we're grateful that our karma came back. And if we accept it as our karma and don't react to it, it's gone. But if we react and get mad at the person who brought our karma back to us, then we're creating a new karma. We haven't gotten rid of a karma. So, you know, the idea is to lessen the karmas we carry. So, the negative karmas, we lessen them. We bring a certain number into life, and how we react to what happens in life determines how many we take out of this life. So let's say we bring in 120 negative karmas into this life. We can take out 150 if we just react in an uncontrolled way. Or we can get rid of 20 of them and leave this life with only 100 left. You know? So that's spiritual progress, you know, lessening the karmas, resolving them. Karma basically is created by mistreating other people. That's what creates karma. And so the reaction is we get mistreated by other people. That's the cycle. And then if we aren't wise enough, we'll do the same thing. Well, they did that to me, I'm going to do it back. You know, when you get in this endless cycle of standing still, of mistreating and retaliation, like Israel and Palestine. You know, they just been stuck. You know, there's no progress. So that's one of the ways of stepping that statement down to a practical level is that the purpose of life is to realize the self means we're moving closer toward moksha by resolving karma. That's one of the aspects of it. Another point, Mahavakya, is we are in truth the truth we seek. So this is a beautiful statement. And what does it point out? Well, it points out, as we mentioned earlier, that in the deepest aspect of us, we are already one with God. God's there. As Yoga Swami said, you know, there's one thing that God can't do. He can't separate himself from us. Right? Meaning, God's in there. No matter how adharmic a person acts, how angry a person can get, God's still inside there. God's sight inside of everyone. Can't separate himself. So we are already that which we seek. We are already one with God. But that's in the center of us, which most people can't experience. You know, it's there. But most people don't get that deeply in themselves, so they don't see it. That doesn't mean it's not true. Just because we don't see it, it's still true. But then Gurudeva adds the idea that the soul body is maturing. Our soul body is becoming like the primal soul. So I call it the mystery of being and becoming. Meaning, we are. Being means we are Shiva. That's the essence of the soul. Becoming means our soul body is becoming more like Shiva. That's the soul body. So both things are true. We are Shiva and we are becoming Shiva. Gurudeva gives us two. And therefore, that's monistic theism. Monism is we are Shiva. The theism is we are separate from Shiva and becoming like Shiva by worshipping Shiva. So we're monistic theists. Our actions and our philosophy have two perspectives. Moving on, group two, nature of God. God Shiva is immanent love and transcendent reality. So this is very helpful, and it takes Shiva out of just the transcendent, which is kind of hard to think about all the time. It's like living in a space station for 20 years or something, you know, it's unnatural to focus on that. You need to come down to earth, and God Shiva's immanent love is a nice way of stating that, or God Shiva is a consciousness that permeates everything and is a consciousness of divine love. And it's a consciousness that each of us can tune into during our deeper meditations and experience that aspect of Shiva as a loving consciousness that pervades all. A wonderful experience. Nature of God. God Shiva is the life of our life. That's a very useful one, which allows everyone to experience God. As Gurudeva explains, all you have to do is look deeply into the eyes of another person, get past their personality, their emotions, see the pure life force in there, and that's God. So everyone can experience God. It's not that hard. And because God is within everyone, then we treat everyone gently and with respect, because God's in there. You know, I don't want to be violent or disrespectful or unkind to people, because God's in there. That's where we're really treating God, that way we treat the other person. So we're all familiar with that one. And it also allows us to get along with people we don't want to get along with. Oh, I don't like that person because they do this, 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 and this. You know, we can easily create a situation where we don't want to get along with someone because of how they act. But, you know, that's not the wisest way to look at it. It's seeing the part of them that they need to improve. It's not seeing the divine part of them. It's already perfect. So, you know, the Spirit of David's approach is everyone is a divine being. No matter how they act, you know, there are no evil people in the world, despite President Bush. There are some people evil, you know, from the Hindu point of view, there aren't any evil people. Everyone's divine. God's within everyone. There's just people that are violent. There are people that are criminals, but they're not evil. Eventually, we'll stop doing that. And society needs to harness them to help them stop doing that. But everyone is a divine being. Group 3, nature of man. Man is not man, man is God. So, of course, that's the philosophy, and that's what how we started in the Upanishads, you know, Aham Brahmasmi. Brahmasi. Man is God. And man is not man, man is God. The essence of the soul, God and man are one. So, of course, that's just Hindu teachings. Almost all Hindus believe that. It's just some Hindus don't, like Vaishnavas maintain the duality. But most Hindus believe in the unity of man and God. But what is unique about Gurudeva is he helps us change our self-concept to one of being a divine being. In other words, he brings it down, helps us bring it into our life. Instead of thinking of ourselves as an unworthy person, or a flawed person, a person who does the wrong things, or a stupid person, whatever, you know, whatever image we've come up with because of our upbringing, Buddha says, no, forget that. You're a divine being. Man is God. You are a divine being. You need to think of yourself as a divine being. So again, that in itself is a wonderful class. But it gives us tools such as the writing down the past and burning it up, Vasanagara Tantra. Gives us a tool of affirmation to change our image. Gives us the philosophy of being a divine being. You know, it helps us. Gives us lots of ways we can change the self-concept we have and make it a self-concept in which we're a divine being, a person. Divine being evolving in experiences of life. So we need to have that thought. And furthermore, you know, if we're raising children, then we want to get our children to have that thought too, or teachers in school, you know, we work with younger people, you know, it's important that they have that concept, you know, they be raised to look at themselves as a worthy individual. Not that everything they do is right, but, you know, the basic distinction we use there is between the person and the behavior. And we can think this way about ourselves too, but it's usually presented in the context of, you know, correcting children. So what the one thing you don't want to say is, boy, you sure are stupid. You're dumb. You know, that's the wrong thing to do. It's the wrong thing to say about ourselves if we do something wrong. You know, we're not dumb, we're divine. Our behavior was dumb. What we did was dumb. What we did was wrong. But that's not who we are. And we are not what we do. We can do the wrong thing. We can do something really wrong. But that still doesn't change who we are. You know, we're a divine being learning. So if we learn from our mistakes, that's the important thing. Not the mistake itself, is learning from it. And feeling good about the whole process. Sometimes we get burdened when we make major mistakes. We lose our self-confidence and our self-image. But we need to keep going. You know, we need to say, well, as long as I learn from that mistake and figure out not how to do it again, how not to do it again, then I'm evolving spiritually, no matter how big the mistake. You just need to figure out how not to do it again. Okay, I did the next one already. Sometimes I do that. I know it's coming up. There is no intrinsic evil. This is very helpful teaching in that it distinguishes between someone's actions and their intrinsic nature. Some men act in good, helpful ways, while others act in evil, harmful ways. Yet the intrinsic nature of both is the same. Each has a divine soul as their essence. So that's what I was just explaining. There is no intrinsic evil. Group 4, a joyful, peaceful life. Life is meant to be lived joyously. That's always a nice one. So that's very important. And sometimes I say, you know, our form of Saivism is called Saivism with a smile. You know, we don't want to be too serious. Or we practice Hinduism with fun. Hinduism should be fun. But sometimes we get too serious, too strict, or technical, or somber. We don't laugh enough, we don't have enough fun. We think religion requires us to be somber and not have fun and not smile. And if we're having fun and smiling at all, it must not be religion. But that's not correct. I mean, that's an incorrect approach. Religion should be lots of fun, joyous time. And we can still be strict with ourselves and smile and have fun. That's the idea. Strict, you know, we're disciplined. We follow certain routines, but we're not somber. We're not serious looking all the time. You know, we have fun and enjoy life. So life is meant to be lived joyously. I'm all right right now. That's a great one. And that addresses the tendency to worry about the future. What if this? What if this? That's going to happen. This is going to happen. You know, there's a tendency of the mind to worry, either about ourselves or tendency of parents to worry about their children or when's he going to come home, you know, what's going on. You know, we just worry. Worry isn't a productive state of mind because you're jumping around. You never come to a conclusion. It's different than thinking about something. Worry, you think it through, you almost get to a conclusion, then you change the subject. Because you'd have to stop worrying if you allowed yourself to think it through, right? And say, oh, I see. And you couldn't think about it anymore. But worry loves to just rehash the same thing. So you almost come to a conclusion, and then you stop thinking about it, and then you think about it again, and stop thinking about it. And you never really come to a positive conclusion regarding the matter. That's worry. So, Lord David says, I'm all right right now. Mm-hmm. And ask yourself the question, am I not all right right now? And answer it, I'm all right right now, until you really convince yourself. Mm-hmm. Because what happens in the future, we really don't know what's going to happen, so there's no point worrying about it. So, this is a good one. For world peace, stop the war in the home. So this, Gurudev would get pretty fiery on this one, about children and spouses getting beaten in the home, and even unkind words spoken in the home, arguments in the home that aren't resolved, and so forth. Also, so many times, Gurudev would go to conferences, and talking about world peace. So, and of course, the conference doesn't make the world a more peaceful place. Remember, they even went to the United Nations for the Millennium Summit of Religious and Spiritual Leaders. And the summit didn't make the world a more peaceful place. So, reaction to all of that is it's just too high in the sky, you know, there's nothing pragmatic here. So let's bring it down to earth, and you know, what can make the world a more peaceful place is each home becoming peaceful. You can take a home that isn't peaceful and make it peaceful. The world is one step closer to being a peaceful place. So that's what's his approach. So, you know, encouraging individuals to have peaceful homes and live in a peaceful way. And if enough people live in a peaceful way, then you have a peaceful community. If enough communities live in a peaceful way, you have a peaceful nation, and so forth. So it's a very nice statement and brings it down to earth. Last one, Hindu solidarity, a unity in diversity. This is a very useful concept in that it's talking about the importance of Hindus standing together, but it's allowing for them to do so by maintaining their diversity. In other words, quite often when you find people talking or groups talking about Hindu solidarity, they want Hinduism to change so that everyone believes the same thing and practices the same thing. They want a unity without diversity. Well, to be strong, we all need to think the same way. We all need to, you know, have one scripture. We all need to have one belief, one God, one this, one that. We want to change the nature of Hinduism just to, you know, achieve solidarity. But that's counterproductive. You know, it takes the power out of Hinduism. It's like eating one food as a meal, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 365 days a year. You know, it's like turning Hinduism into that. It's taking all the diversity out of cuisine, you know, making everything a one meal, a one food. You wouldn't want to eat after a while, right? Just like diversity in cuisine is enjoyed, makes a good meal, so diversity in Hinduism makes for what it is. It's a very diverse set of practices, so it's a very nice statement which allows Hindus to unite, which is important in countries if they all stand together. Like Hindus do pretty well in Malaysia, thanks to the Malaysian Hindu Sangha, where they can stand up and get some things done in the country, get some rice preserved, temples protected, because they all have a one voice, and the Sangam doesn't try and create a unity without diversity. You know, it knows better. It knows that there's a diversity in Hinduism in Malaysia that is how it's always going to be, so we just accept that and work around it. So those are some Mahavakya to get you thinking. So, you're trying to stop at 12 or 15? Is that one last one? 2 minutes before 12?
A few minutes before 12.
Okay, so now it's your turn to do the work. So, the idea is to choose a Mahavakya of Guru Devas that you feel has impacted your life in a meaningful way. It can be one we talked about or another one. And write down how it impacted your life. And then everyone can do that. And then those who want to share, and as much time as we have to share, can share the Mahavakya and how it impacted their life. If you can't think of a Mahavakya, I brought the calendar. Lord Ganesh is always there to steady our minds and open the proper doors as we evolve and progress. Never ever forgets. So each page has a Mahavakya. Well, if you can't think of one, love is the sum of all the spiritual laws. That's a nice one. Each page has one. So this is, we can just pass it around in case someone wants to find a Mahavakya in there. So I'm going to stretch for 10 minutes. Let me take this off. Come back and then do some of your work. So do we have a volunteer? Who would like to be first? Dorothy? Have to speak up.
Lean on your own spine. This was one of Buddha's earliest admonitions to us, and one I found helpful in used over and over through the years. When I was at Brahmacharya from 1968 to 1981, I lived alone most of the time and moved around a lot. I had many different jobs and sometimes no job at all. Leaning on my own spine enabled me to deal with the many, many kinds of experiences I went through. Went through alone, usually, with no one to help me with the gods and Buddha and my mind and resources. Having lived that way for so many years, I was able to develop strength and a wonderful confidence that no matter what experiences life brought to me, I would be able to handle them. I've also tried to teach my children to lean on their own spine so they can go through life with a survival skill.
Thank you. That's my name. Lean on your own spine. Could I have a pen? Okay. Write down. Mahavakya. Okay. Would you like to be next? Yes.
First question. Life is meant to be lived joyously. When we are in a positive, happy state of mind and experiences, we can then be more loving, helpful, and uplifting to others. We can see that things are okay as they work out, whether it's planned and hoped for or not, taking difficulties and challenges more in stride. If we are putting the enjoyment of life, sharing the joy of the moment with others, above the changing circumstances. By seeking the loving grace of God, God's Sadguru, in our hearts and our minds, we can better nurture the higher nature qualities of acceptance, tolerance, patience, and trust in God's guiding presence in all situations, helping us to stay truly in touch with our heart nature of loving kindness. Being secure in a foundation of knowing and experiencing the joy of a loving life daily, we are better able to help uplift others when they are troubled, giving an overview of the goodness of life and caring for each other.
Yes, that's very good.
I'm all right now.
Okay.
Dispels worry in an instant. Dispels nervousness in a hurry. Dispels sadness in a jiff.
Sounds like you've used it a few times. That's good. Yes, listen. Yes.
Ellam mudinja kadai. That means everything finished long ago.
Yes.
And we are now looking for the future and the present.
Thank you. Yes. Yes.
Gurudev asked me if I loved and believed in Lord Ganesha. This was back in the late 70s. I replied that I would like to love and believe in Lord Ganesha, but to be truthful, I have not yet personally experienced Lord Ganesha. So Gurudeva then sent me to New York to live next to and to serve at the new Ganesha temple in Flushing for 3 months. He said in this way I would come to know and love Lord Ganesha. By the way, he said, call me from time to time and let me know how it's going. Next time that I called, he asked how it's going. I told him I was helping the priest every morning with pujas in the temple and doing other chores around the temple grounds.
Mm-hmm.
I said that I had not yet discovered Lord Ganesha in the stone image.
Mm-hmm.
And Gurudeva said, here it comes. He never said, don't worry, just fake it until you make it.
Just fake it until you make it.
So I kept trying and striving to see Lord Ganesha through prayers and devotional song and worship. Then one day Lord Ganesha was suddenly there before me. I was sitting on the floor below this enormous stone murti, and I became fully aware of Lord Ganesha as a true being, smiling and listening and conversing with me.
Mm-hmm. That's a good story. Thank you. That's not in any of our
Unpublished.
Unpublished. Mahan Bhakti. I guess I remember you shared that once before. Okay, who's next? Yes.
We were as some of our inner search on the island team. And it was towards the end of the program when we were giving the talk, and I was just noticing how he was so elegant with his hands and mm-hmm. his hands. But all of a sudden, he said, the energy flowing through my hands is the same energy that flows through you and flows through all form. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the years, he offered me to go back to that and take me right back to that moment.
Yes, that's experiential. That reminds me of a story. I'll just share it. It's a fun story. When I was just getting started with Gurudev, you know, sometimes he would share his inner experiences in meditation, and so he was saying, you know, sometimes he was working with some devotees in Nigeria. Back in about 1960, he would say, you know, sometimes I sit in meditation and I find myself as a consciousness flowing through these huge leaves in Africa. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the energy of seeing energy flowing through everything. So, very interesting. He would just sit there, and he was in Africa in his mind, and so. Dynamically, so. What'd you say? The word there became very palpably present. He could actually see the leaves and feel himself flowing through them. Interesting. It's not a Mahavakya, but it's it's a nice story. Okay, who has a Mahavakya? Yes.
This is a little unfair because my wife's not here. We mm-hmm. scheduled the carpet cleaner, and anyway, she's she'll be here tomorrow. But give your wife everything that she needs, and then give her everything that she wants. Mm-hmm. As my wife and I were working towards zero tolerance for disharmony in the home, and by the way, we've been married 33 years. Our anniversary is in 2 days. Mm-hmm. Only 31 years. Mm-hmm. Right? Husbands are supposed to know this stuff. So as my wife and I were working towards zero tolerance for disharmony in the home, I was blessed to be hosting Gurudeva while he was in Seattle for a book signing. Mm-hmm. And it was during the time he would give me a kashim to do when I hosted him, and one of the things was to meet with the local Hindu community, and then the book signing was very successful. I think we had over 100 people there. And at the time, his talks were focused on stopping the war on the home. And he made the statement, and he said, you know, you men aren't going to like this, but give your wife everything that she needs, and then give her everything that she wants. And so I heard it over and over again. And so I tried it, and it works. And so my feeling on this is that when a man assumes responsibility for what's happening in the home, and he allows his wife to be the sweet, divine being that she is, then the harmony flows naturally. And then another thing is I'm very fortunate that my wife doesn't take advantage of the second part by wanting more than I can handle. And then a little aside to this about zero harmony in the home is we have this dog, and he's a Labrador. And he is just this wonderful, sweet being. And when I brought him home, I took him in the shrine room and did a puja. And I know that dog is a deva. I know he's divine. We cannot raise our voices in our home, even if we're talking to each other from one room to the other. Mm-hmm. So he'll run under the table and hide. So we absolutely cannot raise our voices. So it's another thing that sort of keeps us, you know, it keeps us under control. It keeps that harmony in the home.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are two things for me. The fulfillment, I don't know where I read with this in Mahavakya, mm-hmm. Fulfillment of Bhakti Yoga is to go to next step. Mm-hmm. That is to know thyself. And also, this also has affected my life, see God in you and others, because after reading Gurudeva's books, I don't see the other people as persons. I always see as a soul, and the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I start seeing that I don't hate anyone in my life, or last day, since I met Gurudeva, I don't hate at all anyone. Yes. I see God in them. It has really affected my life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's
good. Also about the faith. This is the Bhakti Yoga, I mean, the fulfillment of Bhakti Yoga. Mm-hmm. If you don't go to the next step, that means our Bhakti Yoga is not fulfilled. Mm-hmm. It is not, we are not succeeding in Bhakti Yoga.
Yes.
That is what I have, on this life here, I have learned.
Yes, that's very important. Thank you. Yes, it's similar to a talk I give. Sometimes I talk to groups that comprise a lot of Yoga Swami devotees who are celebrating Ashlesha, Nakshatra, and Guru Puja quite often. So one of the themes I try and bring out is a similar idea, because quite often devotees of Yoga Swami glorify Yoga Swami, always has all these great attainments, this and this, you know. But that wasn't what Yoga Swami wanted them to do, you know. Yoga Swami wanted them to strive toward those attainments themselves. In other words, to look at Yoga Swami as an inspiration as to what each of us can become. Not to look at Yoga Swami, oh, there he is up there, and here we are down here. That's how it normally happens. But to look at Yoga Swami, oh, there he is way up there, we can become like that too. Isn't that inspiring? Wonder when I'll become like that. You know, to turn it around and look at it as Yoga Swami's attainment as a personal goal for you. A different thing. So it's the same idea that Bhakti Yoga should, in and of itself, shouldn't end there. It should take us the next step. We should learn how to know thyself. From our devotion should lead us into deeper experiences. Very good. Okay, I think we have time for one or two more. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Not to forget the divine gift of God is God. He lays every day. Feel the stream of life is divine flow. Allow it to shelter. Lesson control and judgment show. Water of the river of life is our life and energy. It's pure essence of God. Accept past, present, and future. It's pure. Understanding skills and new body.
Thank you, that's beautiful. Yeah, sometimes I get asked the question, let's see how this comes. What's my soul? So it's, of course, that which is asking the question is the soul. The person is saying, what's my soul? So sometimes we describe it as a body of life, body of light. It's a body of light, this and that. But really, it's you. You are the soul. And it's just that you don't see it. But that's the idea that's being expressed. If we perceive correctly, then we realize that we are the soul. And there are things that surround the soul, and we are the soul. So it's that which we really are, and then other things surround it. Working out an explanation. And sometimes, the person who asks the question is 6 years old. What's my soul? They have to give a simple answer. You can't get that abstract. So, one of the example I'm thinking of developing is, the spacesuit example. If someone lives in a spacesuit for a very, very long time, they forget what it's like not to live in a spacesuit. This is just the way things are. This is who I am, And they have no consciousness of what it would be not to live in a spacesuit. They've been in a spacesuit so long. So similarly, we're the soul in a physical body, and we're so used to being in a physical body that we forget what it would be like for our soul not to be encased in something. Like that. And we've become so identified with the body, likewise, like someone becoming so identified with the spacesuit. But obviously, they're not the spacesuit. And if they took off the spacesuit, they'd remember, oh, that's right, that's what it used to feel like. So similarly, take off the physical body, take off the astral body, you remember, oh, that's what it feels like just to be a soul. Anyway, working on it, I didn't quite have it. But I think it has potential, kind of the physical body and the spacesuit. Okay, time for one last one. Last but not least.
And one ask more? One question.
Ask one question, sure. Yes.
The soul's original character is Goldi character. Go. We are Go.
Yes.
That's the original character.
Right.
When did this negativeness come?
Well, the negativeness comes because we're in a human body, which is both a physical and a mental construct. So the human body has, being in a human body, Gurudeva explains that our nature is threefold: spiritual, intellectual, and instinctive. So threefold nature. The spiritual nature, of course, is the soul. Intellectual nature is the thinking mind, the intellect, the reasoning mind. And the instincts are the animal instincts. It comes along with having physical form. So the instincts are what get us in trouble. We get angry, we get hurtful, and so forth. But the point is, we need to learn to control them. We need to learn to control the instincts as well as the intellect. But first come the instincts, control the tendency to be angry, to harm others, to get fearful, like that. And then we control the intellect, the thinking process, so it doesn't go wild and we're not just endlessly thinking about things without coming to conclusions. And then we have to soften the ego, get rid of the sense that, gee, I'm pretty smart and good, I've got my instincts under control, I've got my intellect under control, I'm a really spiritual person, Obviously we have an ego, we have to soften at that point. through devotional practices. And once we get the instincts, the intellect, and the ego under control and in the right place, then we really feel and act like a spiritual being. So it comes by having human form. By the soul, like Gurudeva said in one of the lessons recently, the soul is temporarily encased in human form. Made it seem very short. Within the last few days' lesson. So when we're no longer encased in human form, then it's not there. And then the answer is, well, why? Because, well, it's like it makes us strong. Our soul, we mature our soul by having to control our instincts. Otherwise, the soul wouldn't mature. It's like, you know, it's a weight. If you want to build a muscle, you have to have a weight to do exercise. If you don't do the exercise, the muscle won't mature. You need something to do. So likewise, if we didn't have the instincts to harness, the soul wouldn't mature. So we strengthen the soul or mature it through controlling the instincts, the intellect, and subduing the ego. And that's what feeds the soul. Body causes it to mature are those efforts. So that's the idea, is it forces us to make effort and therefore mature our soul body. Oh, interesting process, but when it's looked at in the right perspective, it all makes sense. From another perspective, it seems, why do we have to do it that way? Anyway, thank you very much.